You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
And so, with a heavy heart, but with boundless optimism for the long-term future of our nation, we are suspending our campaign.
As Ted Cruz and now John Kasich quit the race for the White House, we'll ask, is there anything the Republicans can do to prevent the reality TV host Donald Trump becoming their nominee for the presidency? Also on the program...
Me dirijo a las naciones ricas para que contribuyan.
Fidel Castro with some tough words for the wealthy at the UN in 1960. But is Chanel's fashion show in Havana evidence that the country is now totally unrecognisable from the early years of the revolution? And also, the contest to become London's mayor has been one of the ugliest in recent British political history. But who will get the keys to City Hall tomorrow night? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are the former diplomat John Everard and Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at RUSI here in London. Welcome to you both. Let's begin with this.
And so, with a heavy heart, but with boundless optimism for the long-term future of our nation, we are suspending our campaign.
Just so you understand, Ted Cruz, I don't know if he likes me or if he doesn't like me, but he is one hell of a competitor. He is a tough, smart guy. And he has got an amazing future.
It now looks all but certain that Donald Trump will contest the US presidential election in November after his victory in Indiana forced both Ted Cruz and, lately, John Kasich to quit the race. Trump's inexorable rise has seen him pick off the darlings of the Republican establishment, Bush, Rubio, Christie and now Cruz. So is the unthinkable now thinkable? Could Donald Trump go all the way in the race for the White House? John Everard, could he?
Well... probably not, no. I think one big effect of today's announcement, Ted Cruz's withdrawal, is that a lot of Republicans will be tearing their hair out. And already we're getting lots of comment pieces across the US media from kind of middle-of-the-road Republicans saying, I just can't vote for this man. And all the polls have been showing fairly consistently that Cruz against Clinton might stand a chance. Trump against Clinton. Clinton has got very clear advantages and is very likely to win the presidency. So, I mean, there'll be a lot of noise, a lot of fury, but I think today the Republican Party just wrote its own death warrant.
And yet, Raffaello Pantucci, this is a two-horse race, and in two-horse races, you know, one of the horses, even if it's got stupid hair and has some, shall we say, interesting views on race and religion, can still win.
I mean, I'd agree. I think that in all the sort of polling we've seen, it certainly seems as though it's now a sure shot for the Democrats. But, you know, I wouldn't count certain things out. For example, you know, Trump in his victory speech against Cruz was at least attempting to be conciliatory in some sort of ways. And it was very baby steps, but I think it hints at the fact that he might be able to tack
towards
the centre.
But can you be conciliatory when you've... I mean, he says, well, I don't know if he likes me. Well, given that you've been calling him a lying Ted for the whole campaign, and only the day before he was referring to Ted Cruz's father apparently being linked to Lee Harvey Oswald based on a story in the National Enquirer.
I would agree, but nevertheless,
my guess is
he can cut Ted Cruz out, that's fine, but you know what, if he can demonstrate or make the appearance that he's able to reach out to other people, if he's able to choose a number two candidate who is someone who's much more from the center of the party, and if we look at some of the people who after they dropped out of the race ended up coming in behind him, and if we think about the logic of the American campaign where it really is one or the other, and a lot of Republicans will want power in some way, shape or form. And so some of them will sort of get over their misgivings and actually go and work for him. It's hard to tell exactly what kind of a party he'll have supporting him. I don't think we're going to see the emergence of a third party candidate, which would be the real sort of killer for him. If that was to happen, then I think we could guarantee that, you know, the Trump campaign is never going to win the next election. But if we think that he's able to demonstrate, at least on the surface, that he is trying to reach back towards the center, that he chooses a number two candidate, a VP, who is someone who's much more from the center of the party, sort of credible individual, then, you know, he could sort of change the dynamic and apparently make the Republicans potentially more appealing. I mean, my sense is that ultimately the campaign will be about people will be voting on what they don't want. And you're going to have a lot of the people who sort of will mobilize against Hillary because they just can't stand the idea of a sort of Clinton, you know, royalty handing the sort of reins of power from one to another. You'll have a group of Democrats who will always vote Democrat. You'll have a group of Republicans who will always vote Republican. And it's the ones in the middle. And I think that the question is how many of those will vote Democrat because they hate Donald Trump so much, and how many of them will vote Republican because they hate Hillary Clinton so much?
I just don't think that Hillary Clinton carries the same hate vote. And sure, you're right. I mean, there are all kinds of people who always have voted Republican. Mm-hmm. I think one of the big changes we're seeing now is that that number is going down. Trump might well try to grab the centre ground. Mm. His big headache is that if he tries that, he risks alienating core Trump supporters, the kind of Americans who foam at the mouth, have very strange hairstyles, and have views that you and I would not wish to express live on air. But these people, there's a lot of them, they're all going to vote for Trump now.
Or I might add. But
here's the problem, though. We're talking about the centre ground, and that's the curious thing about Donald Trump, is that, you know, there was someone on the hard right in this campaign, a true conservative, as some people would say, and that was Ted Cruz. Yeah. Actually, Donald Trump, although, you know, when it comes to his stance on Muslims and his stance on some things to do with foreign policy, are certainly to the right. On other things, you know, there's a lot of crossover with Bernie Sanders, isn't there? He's talking about a lot of things that disaffected white working class voters are quite angry about.
I mean, I'd agree. And then, you know, you can never, I think, underestimate the power of the kind of perceived underdog, whether he really is or not, as a billionaire can really paint himself as an underdog. You know, nonetheless, if he can sort of suggest that he's fighting an insurgent campaign against a sort of Clinton royalty, you know, it does have a dynamic which is difficult to predict. I mean, my sense remains that, you know, if Trump gets the Republican candidacy, it's pretty much a sure shot for the Democrats. And I think all the polling seems to be indicating that direction. But I would be careful to say at this moment in time that, you know, we're categorically never going to see Donald Trump potentially A, get the Republican candidacy, and B, get the campaign.
Here's the tricky thing for Hillary Clinton, John Everard. Does she try to appeal to those centrist moderate Republicans who are already saying, I can't possibly vote for Donald Trump? Even people like John McCain, who, let's not forget, was the party's candidate just 8 years ago, two elections ago, you know, ran against Barack Obama. He is not going to vote for Donald Trump in a million years. Should Hillary Clinton try to appeal to those, or is there then a risk, if she does that she actually loses some of those white working class voters who are already a little bit concerned about her and would rather have Bernie Sanders?
I don't think there's much that she can do to grab back the Bernie Sanders vote. I mean, Bernie Sanders, okay, he's running under a Democratic ticket, or trying to run, rather, but he essentially is, and curiously, a version of Trump. They're both sort of out populists. You know, they both run on opinion polls, and they both try to touch the kind of buttons that get the voters out.
Although, to be fair to Bernie Sanders here, one of these populists talks about banning all Muslims, and the other populist talks about free healthcare.
Yes, I'm not trying to push the parallel to destruction. I'm just noting there are some. There's a bit of overlap there. Hillary Clinton, however, is a position politician. I mean, she will think in terms of which grounds to occupy and so on. And yes, I think she may well be considering moving to grab the disaffected anti-Trump vote from the Republican Party. I think she probably can pull it off. I think, you know, the people who are going for Hillary Clinton within the Democratic fold are going to, not quite whatever she does, but it will take an awful lot to dissuade them at this stage. And she's probably, you know, just facing quite a lot of upside right now.
Raffaello, in, you know, presidential election years in the US, the presidential election is obviously the main election, but there are also other elections for Senate, for Congress, for governorships across the country. But normally, these are essentially two campaigns. There's the Democratic campaign and there's the Republican campaign. There's going to be a difference this time, isn't there? Because there are going to be a lot of Republicans who are going to be running technically on the same ticket as Donald Trump, but they'll want to distance themselves from him as much as possible, not just in terms of personality, but in terms of policy too.
But I would argue, haven't we seen this a bit before with the Tea Party? You know, if you think about the Tea Party as a sort of movement that initially kind of the mainstream Republicans shunned and saw a sort of extreme version that they weren't having to do with, there was people there who were sort of playing this sort of campaign as well, who were sort of avoiding playing, who were saying, oh, well, we're not part of that group, we're part of a different group, we're part of this group,
but except to face the Republican Party. These people still voted the same way. You would have had people voting for a Tea Party Republican congressman and yet also Mitt Romney or John McCain.
Right. Well, isn't that what we're going to see happening this time as well at the end of the day? We're going to have a Donald Trump as the Republican candidate who maybe a lot of these Republicans will reject, but they will still vote for their local constituency vote in a Republican direction if that's what they're going to go. So I don't know if I see a huge amount of change there. I actually think that what we're going to see happen now as Donald Trump sort of becomes the appointed leader, which, you know, could still be upended, right? If I've understood the sort of process of the convention, they could still fight it in some sort of way, though I can't imagine that they would dare go down that path. I think you're going to see an awful lot of the Republican Party start to fall into line behind him. And I think you're probably going to see him kind of shift a little bit. And so I think this dynamic that we see now, which is essentially a party that's ripped itself in half, which is not, I would argue, dissimilar to what you'd seen happen before with the Tea Party, I think will start to mend a little bit and actually start to come together as a more coherent sort of structure.
They've got an awful lot of mending if they're going to come together for the convention. I mean, it's looking pretty rough.
Well, exactly. Just on that point, Rafaela mentioned the word coherent. And coherent is perhaps one word that you wouldn't really use to describe Donald Trump's policies. Let's be kind, his policies. And is it actually possible, John, for Donald Trump to remain as popular as he is with his supporters, whilst at the same time shaping himself into more of a coherent politician who can bring people into his tent?
I think it's going to be really difficult for him to pull that off. I think the more he shapes himself into a coherent politician, the more he looks like the kind of people that he's pledged to fight. Now, he looks like a part of the American machine. That wild mop of hair and the wild statements are actually integral to his campaign. Can I just, as a final thought here, say that we're still looking at this in terms of Trump going forward and the last challenger dropping out. One of Donald Trump's great political achievements is that Donald Trump makes Ted Cruz look acceptable. Am I glad that Donald Trump is going forward to be the candidate? No, I am not.
Yes.
Am I sad that Ted Cruz is out? Absolutely not.
Okay, on that note,
100%.
on that note, with agreement, we will move on to another election slightly closer to home here at Midori House. Londoners will head to the polls tomorrow to elect either Labour's Sadiq Khan or the Conservative Zach Goldsmith as the city's new mayor. Their bids to replace the incumbent Boris Johnson started amicably enough, but as the election has drawn ever closer, it has descended into a dirty street fight. Khan, who is the son of a bus driver and hopes to become London's first Muslim mayor, has accused his rival and his supporters of Islamophobia. Goldsmith's team, in turn, says that the Labour candidate isn't doing enough to address issues of anti-Semitism that have dogged his party in recent weeks. Raffaello Pantucci, I described this election at the start as possibly the dirtiest in recent political British history. And it is actually quite hard to think of an election that's been as nasty as this in recent years here in the UK.
They have been launching an awful lot of, what people call dog whistle tactics, sort of calling all sorts of stories out about the other individual without really engaging on the policies. I mean, what's sort of striking to me about this campaign is how kind of uninspiring I think Zach Goldsmith has really appeared to be. Even in sort of campaign events, when you see him, he doesn't particularly seem comfortable in the role. He sort of lurks in the background. We've seen all sorts of reports of him going on stage with Boris Johnson and Boris sort of upstaging him.
Most people probably would be upstaged by Boris Johnson. Is that Goldsmith's defense?
It's another mop of blonde hair, I might add, I think that it's clearly been very much in that sort of direction. I think all the bookies seem to indicate this much more leaning in the Sadiq Khan direction, but it's sort of depressing in a way that, every day as London is, we get to read the Evening Standard, I do on the sort of public transport as you go here and there. And you just see this campaign, and I've seen very little evidence of engagement on many of the stories and any of the policies. It's much more about the individuals, their personalities, about the fact that, Sadiq Khan has some relations who are a bit dodgy, and once upon a time he worked for, Liberty, which is a human rights organization.
Indeed.
Means you're going to appear with lots of sort of people who may be of sort of questionable political orientations, but, it doesn't mean you necessarily support them. Whereas Zach Goldsmith, we've we've seen, you know, references to his past and where he comes from, but very little engagement on the policies. And what I don't know is if this is because the mayor of London as a position, it's not ever clear to me how much actual power that individual has and whether that's why it is, or if it's just, in many ways, what you're saying, it's just, you know, base politics, and so you just sort of poke at the other person's character.
We'll come on to some of those base politics in a moment, but John Everett, on that issue of, you know, is this partly to do with the fact that actually the mayor of London doesn't have too much power? I mean, let's not forget that this position didn't even exist until 2000, and, you know, the Labour government introduced it. Yes, they were in favour of devolution, but when it came to it, they were slightly wary about how much power they wanted to give to, you know, a single elected person who was out of their control.
Well, that's right, and the powers of the mayor are fairly heavily circumscribed. He has a lot of power over things like housing, and you'll have seen from the various mayoral manifestos, there's a lot of emphasis on this, various of the candidates pledging to build very large numbers of homes to deal with London's housing crisis. The other one is transport, and this has been fascinating, the toing and froing over what London's transport infrastructure might look like at the end of the next mayoral term. A big emphasis coming through on cycling. All the candidates have finally signed up to the London cycling campaign's sort of demands for more cycle superhighways, much better segregation, and so on. And a lot of people will be very careful to hold whoever wins to that. We've been talking just about the mayoral campaign. Of course, this isn't just the mayor, where that London also tomorrow elects its assembly, the 25 assembly members, some of them elected directly, some of them on a proportional vote. Lots of forecasts there suggesting that there might be really quite a big shift away from the current Labour-dominated assembly.
John, just on the issue, you know, of, you know, you mentioned cycling, you mentioned housing, is also part of the issue here, not just that you know, the London mayor doesn't have perhaps as many powers as the other big city mayors around the world do, but that actually, you know, there are a number of issues that the two main candidates sort of agree on. You know, they might disagree on sort of how you fix the housing crisis, but they both accept there is a housing crisis that needs to be fixed. They might disagree on exactly how much cycling provision there should be, but they all accept that there needs to be more.
Yes, there is a lot of overlap, but to a large extent that overlap is driven by exactly the circumscribed powers of the mayor. If the two big areas that you have power over are housing and transport, then your manifesto is going to focus on housing and transport. Both are big problem areas in London, and there's only a limited number of solutions to them. So it's not entirely surprising that on certain points, although they would die rather than admit it, a lot of the candidates agree.
Raffaello, if Sadiq Khan is elected, as the polls suggest is going to happen, although everyone in the UK is slightly wary of polls after what happened this time last year. But if he is, he will be the first Muslim mayor of a major Western city. How important could that be, symbolically?
I mean, I think it would be symbolically important. You know, I think what's fascinating about the position of the mayor in London is, while we may question the powers, I think in sort of democratic terms, as in sort of positions which have the most people voting for them, I think he's like number three in Europe.
It is, you know, after the French president and the Portuguese president.
I thought it was the German chancellor, I must say, but I'm not 100% sure about
not
that.
Not directly elected.
Okay, but it was anyway, two other European leaders. But nonetheless, the point being that this is a very sort of democratically
it's a huge
heavy
mandate,
position.
Yes.
You know what I mean? You're getting a lot of people who are voting specifically for this position, and that is symbolic. And I think it's important that, you know, if we do have a London mayor who's a Muslim, a born Muslim, you know, I think that you're looking at something which will have a lot of kind of ideological power. The depressing thing is that in some ways, there's a sort of negative side to that, which will probably play out as well, which is that to extremists on the Islamist side of the equation, they will just dismiss it anyway. And frankly, they would always go in the sort of extremist direction. And then there's the other worry about what it will do for the increasingly sort of tense relations you see within Europe between far right parties and the sort of Muslim communities that we see coming in the form of refugees. And we see the tensions that's playing out across the continent. And play this in a negative light, you know.
But indeed, but isn't there, and you know, it has been, you know, a horrible campaign in the way that essentially Sadiq Khan's religion has been used as a stick to beat him with, when he is, you know, as moderate and as mainstream as any British politician could be. You've written a lot about, and you've reported a lot about young Muslims in the UK and extremism. Do you think the fact that there would be a a prominent Muslim in a position of power in the UK would make a difference to some young Muslims in Britain?
I think it would. It gives you another person to aspire to, you know, and I think having these sorts of symbols of aspiration is certainly important and is certainly essential. I don't think, however, it's going to resolve the problem altogether, but I do think it is an important thing, and I think it's fantastic that we're going to do it. And it just speaks volumes to me about the fact that, you know, people may say, oh, England's a broken country and, you know, we've just got these divisions. And actually, no, that's entirely not true. We've got a country that's accepting enough to have an individual voted into a maybe politically less significant position, but certainly a democratically very relevant position to, you know, what I'd argue is the greatest city in the world, which I say with bias having been born here, to have someone of this sort of background born into this society to rise up to this position of power is, I think, a fantastic signal to the world.
Okay, we'll leave it there just for now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. In a moment, could Cuba's revolutionaries soon be buying Chanel sunglasses to complement their trademark Adidas tracksuits? But first, this.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week. With me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guests John Everard and Raffaella Pantucci still with me in studio. Now, if the London elections have been a little ugly, then the run-up to the presidential elections in the Philippines have been downright nasty. The front-runner, Rodrigo Duterte, has promised to kill criminals in the streets and recently made a joke about raping a missionary, if we can call it a joke. The son of a dictator is running to be the country's vice president, and a homophobic boxer also looks set to become a senator. John Everard, the Philippines.
Yes.
Again, to talk about democracies, and you know, this is a big democracy with a relatively fair and free election, but it is also quite a young democracy, isn't it?
It is a young democracy, but as a democracy, it's rather curiously showing Trump-like syndromes. We've just been talking about Donald Trump in the United States. Here we have Duterte, Rodrigo Duterte, known as Duterte Harry to his very few friends, a rough guy, the former mayor Davao, who has said that he wants to send death squads into the streets, forgive all soldiers who exceed their powers on criminals. He seems incapable of making a speech without lacing it with obscenities and sexist remarks. I mean, somebody who the Filipino political establishment is clearly very uncomfortable with, and who came from nowhere. I remember sitting in the studio in January where we were talking about Filipino politics. His name didn't even come up. He was nowhere. Soared to lead the polls in April, now somewhere between 9 and 12 points ahead of his nearest rival, and still surging ahead. I think this is really sort of a rather worrying phenomenon. I mean, you know, the rise of populism.
And he has got a bit of a Trumpian vibe to him as well. He called the Pope a son of a bitch, and yet was still forgiven by Catholics in the country.
Absolutely. He's also got a Trumpian vibe. I don't know if you followed his stunt today. He's been accused of receiving illicit money, so he's pitched up in front of the cameras with a clutch of passbooks to his various bank accounts and said, this proves that I am straight, honest and uncorrupt. When the media said, fine, that's good, show us the passports, he said no and put them away, which again, straight from Donald Trump's playbook. And as I say, the establishment is in shock over this. The polling is really, really strange. It was showing just 8 weeks ago an almost shoo-in for Grace Poe, who's a kind of right-of-centre, neoliberal candidate, sensible, a certain amount of fire in her belly, and who most Filipinos thought would make a good president. And she's just been sort of swept away now. I mean, 12 points away. Polling, incidentally, when we talk about polling in most Western European democracies, you have visions of people going around with clipboards and asking the opinions of people in the streets. In the Philippines, it all works a bit differently. The way they do it is that the 7-Eleven stores sell drinks, as they do anywhere else in the world, and you poll by offering customers different colour mugs depending on which candidate they say they support, and counting the number of colour mugs as they walk out of the stores. This polling, rather idiosyncratic, shall we say, proved actually the most accurate predictor of the last electoral result. And so far, this time round, it is showing Duterte Harry.
Although, of course, as you suggest, it's perhaps not the most accurate in the world. Although, having said that, we were just talking about polling and how that hasn't always worked in this country. Mm. Maybe Ipsos Mori and their friends could use the mugs in 7-Eleven option. Rafael Pantucci, you know, the Philippines, you know, election is going to be watched very closely within the region and also by Australia as well. How much impact do you think the outcome of this election will have on the region?
I think it's probably difficult to judge, in part because it's difficult to see who the figure is who comes out in top. You know, I mean, the difficulty is with any country, if you get a charismatic enough leader in who's got a sort of enough of a personality that can kind of stretch beyond his borders, it becomes a very unpredictable actor. And within a regional context, that can be very disruptive. We think how difficult the sort of environment around the Philippines is and the relationship with China, the relationship with Australia, you've already mentioned, but looking at some of the other Southeast Asian nations, you know, it could upend some sort of a regional balance, though it is already pretty sort of chaotic at the moment. I don't know that this particular election is going to be wildly significant, but it's very difficult, as I say, to predict.
Is it something, though, that, you know, when you're talking to Chinese contacts, mm-hmm. that they have some concerns over which direction the Philippines might go in? As you say, if, for example, they have an unpredictable leader.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, the Chinese see the Philippines as a power that is very close to the United States. And so I think if they're looking in a sort of regional context, they'd probably see it through that lens. And I don't think whoever's... I haven't been following the election in nearly as much detail as others have, but my sense is I don't think that the United States is featured as a big element within the campaign that people are going to break one way or the other on, though John may correct me.
No, the United States, Duterte Harry has said he will break relations with the United States.
Okay, so I stand corrected.
But I think that's the kind of, you know, the rape missionary sort of approach to politics, isn't it? I think the Chinese would almost prefer that Duterte one than most of the others, simply because most of the other candidates have declared that they will follow a hardline policy on protecting Filipino sovereignty against what they regard as Chinese incursions in what the Chinese call the South China Sea, what Filipinos call the West Philippine Sea. Duterte has very carefully not said anything about this, so they probably reckon that with him, they're at least in with a chance.
Okay, we'll head to Havana now, where Chanel has held the first international fashion show in Cuba since this man seized power.
Me dirijo a las naciones ricas para que contribuyan. Me dirijo a los países pobres para que distribuyan.
That was Fidel Castro with some strong words for the wealthy when speaking at the United Nations in 1960, and it might perhaps explain why some Cubans chose to show their displeasure at the fashion house's presence in their capital city. Indeed, some staged a demonstration outside Chanel's venue. But is this further evidence that Cuba is opening up to the rest of the world? John, when I said before that people might be buying Chanel, you said no, they can't, because it's just a fashion show, they're not on sale. So in a sense, this is a mild opening up.
This is a mild opening up. It's something for ordinary Cubans to look at, even if they were allowed to buy Chanel. Remember that the average wage in Cuba is about $25 a month. You don't get much Chanel for that, to be honest. And it's understandable that as it opens up, this causes friction. Not surprising that people demonstrate against what they must see as an upending of the revolution for which they have made such sacrifices. There's another bit of symbolism here that a lot of the media seems to miss, that what Chanel did was to take over Prado, which is the main street, you know, the smart street through central Havana, and the police cordoned it off and they turned it into a catwalk. If, like me, you've wasted your youth watching films about Cuba from the 1940s, from before Castro Revolution, you'll recognise that street. That is where all the beautiful people under Batista used to hang out in all their fantastically expensive clothes, driven there in their fantastically expensive state-of-the-art cars, some of which, of course, are now vintage, wandering around. To Cubans of a certain age, seeing that fashion display will have rung bells that will have left a lot of people really very uncomfortable.
Raffaello, you know, we've talked a lot and written a lot about Cuba's opening up, you know, and one of the big challenges is going to be that, you know, if the economy changes too much, you know, it is likely to come with increased inequality. And how are, you know, ordinary Cubans going to respond to that? When we look at other, you know, nominally communist countries, like, for example, China, which are now incredibly capitalist, that mix doesn't always work so well.
No, absolutely not. And if you think about China, I mean, I lived in Shanghai for many years, and I remember seeing fairly regularly there was, you know, catwalk shows happening in downtown Shanghai along the Bund or in the sort of big glass nice buildings there. And so this was happening regularly. We didn't see anywhere near these sorts of protests because you did have people wealthy enough who could actually purchase some of these things. And there was that kind of aspiration that was already built into the Chinese system. I think the fact that you're seeing this happen at such lightning speed overnight in Cuba is going to create a sort of tensions, which in some ways are more likely to express themselves in a kind of Russian model than necessarily in the Chinese model, which happened over a more extended period of time.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Rafael Pantucci and John Everard, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Charlie Monaghan and Hannah Ritchie. Chris Chilvers was the studio manager. More music next. Then it's The Entrepreneurs. Midori House, back with me, same time tomorrow. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.